opposed would inevitably have drawn the council into mortal conflicts and therefore into mortal politics. Tell me the truth. If the council, today, declared war upon America for its past crimes and current idiocy, would you obey the order to attack? Hell no, I said. The U.S. isn't a perfect place, but it's better than most people have managed to come up with. And all my stuff is there. She smiled faintly. Exactly. And since the council is made up of members from all over the world, it would mean that no matter where we acted, we would almost certainly be faced with dissidence and desertion from those who felt their homelands wronged. She shrugged and grimaced in pain before arresting the motion. I myself would have issues if the council acted against any of the lands where my family is settled. They may not remember me, but the reverse is not true. I thought about what she said for a long moment. What you're saying is that the council would have to turn on some of its own. And how many times would that happen before there was no council? She asked. Wars and feuds can live for generations, even when there isn't a group of wizards involved. Settling the conflicts would have required even more involvement in mortal affairs. You mean control, I said quietly. You mean the council seeking political power. She gave me a knowing look. One of the things that makes me respect you more than most young people is your appreciation for history. Precisely. And for gaining control over others, for gathering great power to oneself, there is no better tool than black magic. Which is what the laws of magic cover already. She nodded. And so the council limits itself. Any wizard is free to act in whatever manner he chooses with his power, provided he doesn't break any of the laws. Without resorting to black magic, the amount of damage an individual can inflict on mortal society is limited. As harsh an experience as it has created for you, Harry, the laws of magic are not about justice. The White Council is not about justice. They are about restraining power. She smiled faintly. And occasionally the Council manages to do some good by protecting mankind from supernatural threats. And that's good enough for you? I asked. It isn't perfect, she admitted, but it's better than anything else we've come up with. And the things I've spent my lifetime building are there. Touché, I said. Thank you. I stroked her fingers with my thumb. So you're saying my mother was short-sighted? She was a complex woman, Anastasia said. Brilliant, erratic, passionate, committed, idealistic, talented, charming, insulting, bold, incautious, arrogant, and short-sighted, yes, among a great many other qualities. She loved pointing out the areas of gray magic, as she called them, and constantly questioning their legitimacy. She shrugged. The senior council tasked the wardens to keep an eye on her, which was damn near impossible. Why? The woman had a great many contacts among the Fae. That's why everyone called her Margaret Le Fay. She knew more ways through the Never Never than anyone I've ever seen, before or since. She could be in Beijing at breakfast, Rome at lunch, and Seattle for supper, and stop for coffee in Sydney and Cape Town in between. She sighed. Margaret vanished once, for 4 or 5 years. Everyone assumed that she'd finally run afoul of something in fairy. She never seemed able to restrain her tongue, even when she knew better. I wonder what that's like. Anastasia gave me a rather worn, sad smile. But she didn't spend all that time in fairy, did she? I looked up at the rearview mirror back toward Chateau Wraith. And Thomas is the son of the White King himself. I didn't answer. She exhaled heavily. You look so different from him. Except perhaps for something in the jaw, the shape of the eyes. I didn't say anything until we got to the apartment. The rolls went together with the gravel lot like champagne and Cracker Jacks. I turned the engine off and listened to it click as it began to cool down. The sun was gone over the horizon by that time, and the lengthening shadows began to trigger streetlights. Are you going to tell anyone? I asked quietly. She looked out the window as she considered the question. Then she said, Not unless I think it relevant. I turned to look at her. You know what will happen if they know. They'll use him. She gazed straight out the front of the car. I know. I spoke quietly to put all the weight I could into each word I spoke next. Over my dead body. Anastasia closed her eyes for a moment and opened them again. Her expression never flickered. She took her hand slowly, reluctantly, from mine and put it in her lap. Then she whispered, I pray to God it never comes to that. We sat in the car separately. It seemed larger and colder for some reason. The silence seemed deeper. Lucio lifted her chin and looked at me. What will you do now? What do you think? I clenched my fists so that my knuckles popped, rolled my neck once, and opened the door. I'm going to find my brother. Chapter 29. 2 hours and a half a dozen attempted tracking spells later, I snarled and slapped a stack of notepads off the corner of the table in my sub-basement laboratory. They thwacked against the wall beneath Bob the Skull's shelf and fell to the concrete floor. It was to be expected, Bob the Skull said very quietly. Orange lights, like the flickers of distant campfires, glittered in the eye sockets of the bleached human skull that sat on its own shelf, high up on one wall of my lab, bracketed by the remains of dozens of melted candles and half a dozen paperback romances. The parent-to-child blood bond is much more sympathetic than that shared by half-siblings. I glared at the skull and also kept my voice down. You just can't go a day without saying that you told me so. I can't help it if you're wrong all the time, yet continually ignore my advice, Sahib. I'm just a humble servant. I couldn't scream at my non-material assistant with other people in the apartment above me, so I consoled myself by snatching up a pencil from a nearby work shelf and flung it at him. Its eraser end hit the skull between the eyes. Jealousy, thy name is Dresden, Bob said with a pious sigh. I paced up and down the length of my lab, burning off frustrated energy. It wasn't much of a walk. Five paces, turn, five paces, turn. It's a dank little concrete box of a room. Workbenches lined three of the walls, and I had installed cheap wire shelving above them. The workbenches and shelves are crowded with all manner of odds and ends. Reagents, instruments, various bits of gear needed for alchemy, and scores of books and notebooks. A long table in the middle of the room was currently covered by a canvas tarp, and the floor at the far end of the lab had a perfect circle of pure copper embedded in it. The remains of several differently structured tracking attempts were scattered on the floor around the circle, while the props and foci from the most recent failures were still inside it. One of them should have gotten me something, I told Bob. Maybe not a full lock on Thomas's position, but a tug in the right direction at least. Unless he's dead, Bob said, in which case you're just spinning your wheels. He isn't dead, I said quietly. Shagnasty wants to trade. Uh-huh, Bob scoffed, because everyone knows how honorable the Nagloshi are. He's alive, I said quietly, or at least I'm going to proceed on that assumption. Bob somehow managed to look baffled. Why? Because you need your brother to be all right, whispered a quiet voice in my head. Because anything else isn't particularly useful toward resolving the situation, I said aloud. Whoever is behind the curtains is using the skinwalker, and probably Madeline Wraith, too. So, if I find Thomas, I find Shagnasty and Madeline, and I'll be able to start pulling threads until this entire mess unravels. Yeah, Bob said, drawing out the word. Do you think it'll take long to pull all those threads? Because the Nagloshi is going to be doing something similar to your intestines. I made a growling sound in my throat. Yeah, I think I got its number. Really? I keep trying to punch Shagnasty out myself, I said, but its defenses are too good, and it's fast as hell. He's an immortal, semi-divine being, Bob said. Of course he's good. I waved a hand. My point is that I've been trying to lay the beating on it myself. Next time I see it, I'm going to start throwing bindings on it, just to trip it up and slow it down, so whoever is with me can get a clean shot. It might work, Bob admitted. Thank you. If he's such an idiot that he only bothered to learn to defend himself from violent energy attacks, Bob continued, as if I hadn't spoken, which I think is almost as likely as you getting one of those tracking spells to work. He'll know how to defend himself from bindings, Harry. I sighed. I've got gender issues. Bob blinked slowly. Wow. I'd love to say something to make that more embarrassing for you, boss, but I'm not sure how. Not my... I threw another pencil. It missed Bob and bounced off the wall behind him. With the skinwalker. Is it actually a male? Do I call it a he? Bob rolled his eyelids. It's a semi-divine immortal, Harry. It doesn't procreate. It has no need to recombine DNA. That means that gender simply doesn't apply. That's something only you meat sacks worry about. Then why is it that you stare at naked girls every chance you get, I said, but not naked men? It's an aesthetic choice, Bob said loftily. As a gender, women exist on a plane far beyond men when it comes to the artistic appreciation of their external beauty. And they have boobs, I said. And they have boobs, Bob agreed with a leer. I sighed and rubbed at my temples, closing my eyes. You said the skinwalkers were semi-divine? You're using the English word, which doesn't really describe them very precisely. Most skinwalkers are just people, powerful, dangerous, and often psychotic people, but people. They're successors to the traditions and skills taught to avaricious mortals by the originals, the Nagloshi. Originals like Shag Nasty, I said. He's the real deal, all right, Bob replied, his quiet voice growing more serious. According to some of the stories of the Navajo, the Nagloshi were originally messengers for the holy people, when they were first teaching humans the blessing way. Messengers, I said. Like angels? Or like those guys on bikes in New York, maybe, Bob said. Not all couriers are created identical, Mr. Lowest Common Denominator. Anyway, the original messengers, the Nagloshi, were supposed to go with the holy people when they departed the mortal world. But some of them didn't. They stayed here, and their selfishness corrupted the power the holy people gave them. Voila, Shag Nasty. I grunted. Bob's information was anecdotal, which meant it could well be distorted by time and by generations of retelling. There probably wasn't any way to know the objective truth of it, but a surprising amount of that kind of lore remained fundamentally sound in oral tradition societies, like those of the American Southwest. When did this happen? Tough to say, Bob said. The traditional Navajo don't see time the way most mortals do, which makes them arguably smarter than the rest of you monkeys. But it's safe to assume prehistory, several millennia. Yikes. Thousands of years of survival meant thousands of years of accumulated experience. It meant that Shag Nasty was smart and adaptable. The old skinwalker wouldn't still be around if it wasn't. I upgraded the creature in my thoughts from very tough to damn near impossibly tough. But since it still had my brother, that didn't change anything. Don't suppose there's a silver bullet we can use, I asked. No, boss, Bob said quietly. Sorry. I grimaced, did a half-assed job of cleaning up the mess I'd made, and began to leave the lab. I paused before I left and said, Hey, Bob.
Yeah.
Any thoughts as to why, when Lafortier was being murdered by a wizard, no one threw any magic around? People are morons? It's damn peculiar, I said. Irrationality isn't, Bob said. Wizards just aren't all that stable to begin with. Given what I had done with my life lately, I could hardly argue with him. It means something, I said.
Yeah? Bob asked. What?
I shook my head. Tell you when I figure it out. I went back up into my living room through the trap door in its floor. The door was a thick one. Sound didn't readily travel up from the lab when it was closed. Lucio was loaded with narcotics and asleep on my couch, lying flat on her back with no pillow and covered with a light blanket. Her face was slack, her mouth slightly open. It made her look vulnerable and even younger than she already appeared. Molly sat in one of the recliners with several candles burning beside her. She was reading a paperback, carefully not opening the thing all the way to avoid creasing the spine. Pansy. I went to the kitchen and made myself a sandwich. As I did, I reflected that I was getting really tired of sandwiches. Maybe I ought to learn to cook or something. I stood there munching, and Molly came to join me. Hey, she said in muted tones. How are you? She'd helped me bandage the fairly minor cut on my scalp when I had returned. Strips of white gauze bandage were wound around my head to form a lopsided off-kilter halo. I felt like the fife player in Willard's iconic Spirit of 76. Still in one piece, I replied. How are they?
Drugged and sleeping, she said. Morgan's fever is up another half of a degree. The last bag of antibiotics is almost empty. I clenched my jaw. If I didn't get Morgan to a hospital soon, he was going to be just as dead as he would be if the council or Shag Nasty got hold of him.
Should I get some ice onto him? Molly asked anxiously.
Not until the fever goes over 104 and stays there, I said. That's when it begins to endanger him. Until then, it's doing what it's supposed to do and slowing the infection. I finished the last bite of sandwich. Any calls?
She produced a piece of notebook paper. Georgia called. Here's where Andy is. They're still with her.
I took the paper with a grimace. If I hadn't let Morgan in my door half an eternity ago, he wouldn't have been in Chicago. Shag Nasty wouldn't have been tailing me to find him. Andy wouldn't be hurt, and Kirby would still be alive. And I hadn't even tried to call and find out how she was.
How is she?
They still aren't sure, Molly said.
I nodded.
Okay.
Did you find Thomas?
I shook my head. Total bust. Mouse came shambling over. He sat down and looked up at me, his expression concerned. She chewed on her lip.
What are you going to do?
My voice trailed off. I sighed.
I have no idea.
Mouse pawed at my leg and looked up at me. I bent over to scratch his ears and instantly regretted it as someone tightened a vise on my temples. I straightened up again in a hurry, wincing, and entertained wild fantasies about lying down on the floor and sleeping for a week. Molly watched me, her expression worried.
Right, Harry, you are still teaching your apprentice. Show her what a wizard should do, not what you want to do.
I looked at the paper.
The answer isn't obvious, which means that I need to put some more thought into it. And while I'm doing that, I'll go look in on Andy.
Molly nodded.
What do I do?
Hold down the fort. Try to reach me at the hospital if anyone calls or if Morgan gets any worse.
Molly nodded seriously.
I can do that.
I nodded and grabbed my gear and the key to the rolls. Molly went to the door, ready to lock it behind me when I left. I started to do just that and then paused. I turned to my apprentice.
Hey.
Yeah?
Thank you.
She blinked at me.
What did I do?
More than I asked of you. More than was good for you. I leaned over and kissed her on the cheek.
Thank you, Molly.
She lifted her chin a little, smiling.
Well, she said, you're just so pathetic. How could I turn away?
That made me laugh, if only for a second, and her smile blossomed into something radiant.
You know the drill, I said.
She nodded.
Keep my eyes open. Be super careful. Don't take any chances.
I winked at her.
You grow wiser, grasshopper.
Molly started to say something, stopped, fidgeted for half a second, and then threw her arms around me in a big hug.
Be careful, she said. Okay?
I hugged her back tight and gave the top of her head a light kiss.
Hang in there, kid. We'll get this straightened out.
Okay, she said.
We will.
Then I headed out into the Chicago night wondering how, or if, that was possible.
Chapter 30.
I don't like hospitals, but then who does? I don't like the clean, cool hallways. I don't like the stark fluorescent lights. I don't like the calm ringtones on the telephones. I don't like the pastel scrubs the nurses and attendants wear. I don't like the elevators, and I don't like the soothing colors on the walls. And I don't like the way everyone speaks in measured, quiet voices. But mostly, I don't like the memories I've collected there. Andy was still in intensive care. I wouldn't be able to go in to see her. Neither would Billy and Georgia if they hadn't arranged for power of attorney for medical matters a few years back. It was long after standard visiting hours, but most hospital staffs stretch rules and look the other way for those whose loved ones are in the ICU. The world has changed a lot over the centuries, but death watches are still respected. Billy had come to me on the down low to set up power of attorney for me in case he should be hospitalized without Georgia being nearby to handle matters. Though neither of us said so, we both knew why he really did it. The only reason Georgia wouldn't be there is if she was dead. And if Billy was in no shape to make decisions for himself, he didn't want to hang around and find out what his world would be like without her in it. He wanted someone he could trust to understand that. Billy and Georgia are solid. I'd spent some endless hours in Stroger's ICU waiting room, and it hadn't changed since I'd been there last. It was empty except for Georgia. She lay on the sofa, sleeping, still wearing her glasses. A book by what was presumably a prominent psychologist lay open on her stomach. She looked exhausted. I bypassed the waiting room and went to the nurse's desk. A tired-looking woman in her 30s looked up at me with a frown.
"Sir," she said, "it's well after visiting hours."
"I know," I said. I took my notepad out of my pocket and scribbled a quick note on it. "I'll go back to the waiting room. The next time you go past Miss Macklin's room, could you please give this to the gentleman sitting with her?" The nurse relaxed a little and gave me a tired smile.
"Certainly. It'll be just a few minutes."
"Thanks." I went back to the waiting room and settled into a chair. I closed my eyes, leaned my head back against the wall, and drowsed until I heard footsteps on tile. Billy entered with a rolled-up blanket under his arm, glanced around the room, and nodded to me. Then he went immediately to Georgia. He took her glasses off, very gently, and picked up the book. Georgia never stirred. He put the book on the end table and her glasses on top of it. Then he took the blanket from under his arm and covered her up. She murmured and stirred, but Billy shushed her quietly and stroked his hand over her hair. She sighed and shifted onto her side, then snuggled down under the blanket. I reached up a hand and flicked the light switch beside my head. It left the room dim, if not really dark. Billy smiled his thanks to me and nodded toward the door. I got up and we walked out into the hallway together.
"Should have tried to call you sooner," I said. "I'm sorry."
He shook his head.
"I know how it is, man. No apology needed."
"Okay," I said, without actually agreeing with him.
"How is she?"
"Not good," he replied simply.
"There was internal bleeding. It took 2 rounds of surgery to get it stopped." The blocky young man shoved his hands into the pockets of his jeans. "They told us if she makes it through the night, she'll be out of the worst of it."
"How are you holding up?"
He shook his head again.
"I don't know, man. I called Kirby's folks. I was his friend. I had to. The police had already contacted them, but it isn't the same."
"No, it isn't."
"They took it pretty hard. Kirby was an only child."
I sighed.
"I'm sorry."
He shrugged.
"Kirby knew the risks. He'd rather have died than stand by and do nothing."
"Georgia?"
"I'd have lost it without her.
Pillar of strength and calm," Billy said.
He glanced back toward the waiting room and a smile touched the corners of his eyes.
"She's good at setting things aside until there's time to deal with them. Once things have settled out, she'll be a wreck, and it'll be my turn to hold her up."
Like I said, solid. The thing that did Kirby took Thomas Wraith, I said.
The vampire you work with sometimes?
Yeah. As soon as I work out how to find it, I'm taking it down. The vampires are probably going to help, but I might need backup I can trust. Billy's eyes flickered with a sudden fire of rage and hunger.
Yeah?
I nodded. It's part of something bigger. I can't talk to you about everything that's going on, and I know Andy needs you here. I understand if you don't. Billy turned his eyes to me, those same dangerous fires smoldering. Harry, I'm not going to move forward blind anymore.
What do you mean?
I mean that for years I've been willing to help you, even though you could barely ever tell me what was actually happening. You've played everything close to the chest, and I know you had your reasons for that. He stopped walking and looked up at me calmly.
Kirby's dead. Maybe Andy, too.
My conscience wouldn't let me meet his gaze, even for an instant.
I know.
He nodded. So, if I'd had this conversation with you sooner, maybe they wouldn't be. Maybe if we'd had a better idea about what's actually going on in the world, it would have changed how we approached things. They follow my lead, Harry. I have a responsibility to make sure that I do everything in my power to make them aware and safe.
Yeah, I said.
I can see your point. Then if you want my help, things are going to change. I'm not charging ahead blindfolded again. Not ever.
Billy, I said quietly, this isn't stuff you can unlearn. Right now, you're insulated from the worst of what goes on because you're... I don't want to be insulting, but you're a bunch of amateurs without enough of a clue to be a real threat to anyone.
His eyes darkened.
Insulated from the worst? He asked in a quiet, dangerous voice. Tell that to Kirby. Tell that to Andy.
I took several steps away, pinched the bridge of my nose between thumb and forefinger, and closed my eyes, thinking. Billy had a point, of course. I'd been careful to control what information he and the Alphas had gotten from me in an effort to protect them, and it had worked for a while. But now things were different. Kirby's death had seen to that.
You're sure you don't want to back out? I asked.
Once you're part of the scene, you aren't getting out of it. I clenched my jaw for a second.
And believe it or not, Billy, yes, you have been insulated from the worst.
I'm not backing off on this one, Harry. I can't.
Out of the corner of my eye, I saw him fold his arms.
You're the one who wants our help.
I pointed a finger at him. I don't want it. I don't want to drag you into what's going on. I don't want you walking into more danger and getting hurt. I sighed.
But there's a lot at stake, and I think I might need you.
Okay, then, Billy said. You know what it will cost.
He stood facing me solidly, tired eyes steady. And I realized something I hadn't ever made into a tangible thought before. He wasn't a kid anymore. Not because he'd graduated, and not even because of how capable he was. He'd seen the worst. Death, heartless and nasty, come to lay waste to everything it could. He knew in his heart of hearts, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that it could come for him, take him as easily as it had taken Kirby. And he was making a choice to stand his ground. Billy Borden, Kid Werewolf, was gone. Will was choosing to stand with me. I couldn't treat him like a child anymore. Will was ignorant of the supernatural world beyond the fairly minor threats that lurked around the University of Chicago. He and the other werewolves had been kids who learned one really neat magic trick almost 10 years before. I hadn't shared more with them, and the paranormal community in general is careful about what they say to strangers. He had, at best, only a vague idea of the scope of supernatural affairs in general, and he had not the first clue about how hot the water really was around me right now. Will had picked his ground. I couldn't keep him in the dark and tell myself that I was protecting him. I nodded to a few chairs sitting along the wall at a nearby intersection of hallways.
Let's sit down.
I don't have much time, and there's a lot to cover. I'll tell you everything when I get a chance, but for now, all I can give you is a highlights reel. By the time I got done giving Will the Cliff Notes version of the supernatural world, I still hadn't come up with a plan. So, working on the theory that the proper answers just needed more time to cook, and that they could do so while I was on the move, I went back to my borrowed car and drove to the next place I should have visited sooner than I had. Murphy used to have an office at the headquarters of CPD's Special Investigations Department. Then she'd blown off her professional duty as head of the department to cover me during a furball that went bad on an epic scale. She'd nearly lost her job altogether, but Murph was a third-generation cop from a cop clan. She'd managed to gain enough support to hang on to her badge, but she had been demoted to detective sergeant and had her seniority revoked, a dead end for her career. Now her old office was occupied by John Stallings, and Murphy had a desk in the large room that housed SI. It wasn't a new desk, either. One leg was propped up with a small stack of triplicate report forms. It wasn't unusual in that room. SI was the bottom of the chute for cops who had earned the wrath of their superiors, or worse, had taken a misstep in the cutthroat world of Chicago city politics. The desks were all battered and old. The walls and floor were worn. The room obviously housed at least twice as many work desks as it had been meant to contain. It was late. The place was quiet and mostly empty. Whoever was on the night shift must have been out on a call of some kind. Of the three cops in the room, I only knew one of them by name, Murphy's current partner, a blocky, mildly overweight man in his late 50s, with hair going steadily more silver in sharp contrast to the dark coffee tone of his skin. "Rawlins," I said. He turned to me with a grunt and a polite nod. "Evening. What are you doing here this late?" "Giving my wife ammunition for when she drags my ass to court to divorce me," he said cheerfully. "Glad you made it in." "Murph around?" I asked. He grunted. "Interrogation room 2 with the British perp. Go on down." "Thanks, man." I went down the hall and around the corner. To my left was a security gate blocking the way to the building's holding cells. To the right was a short hallway containing 4 doors, 2 to the bathrooms and 2 that led to the interrogation rooms. I went to the second room and knocked. Murphy answered it, still wearing the same clothes she'd been in at the storage park. She looked tired and irritated. She grunted almost as well as Rawlins had, despite her complete lack of a Y chromosome, and stepped out into the hall, shutting the door behind her. She looked up and studied my head for a second. "What the hell, Harry?" "Got a visit from Shagnasty the Skinwalker when I went to talk to Lara Wraith. Any trouble with Binder?" She shook her head. "I figured he'd have a hard time doing whatever he does if he can't get out of his chair or use his hands. I've been sitting with him, too, in case he tried to pull something." I lifted an eyebrow, impressed. There hadn't been time to advise her how to handle Binder safely, but she'd worked it out on her own. "Yeah, that's a pretty solid method," I said. "What's he in for, officially?" "Officially, I haven't charged him yet," she said. "If I need to stick him with something, I can cite trespassing, destruction of property, and assault on a police officer." She shook her head. "But we can't keep this close an eye on him forever. If I do press charges, it won't be long before he's under lighter security. I don't even want to think about what could happen if he got to turn those things loose inside a precinct house or prison." "Yeah," I said, nodding. "Long term, I don't think you can hold him." Her mouth twisted bitterly. "Hate it when I have to let pricks like that walk."
"Happen much?"
"All the time," she said. "Legal loopholes, incorrect procedures, crucial evidence declared inadmissible. A lot of perps who are guilty as hell walk out without so much as a reprimand." She sighed and twitched her shoulders into something like a shrug. "Ah, well, it's a messed up world. What you gonna do?"
"I hear that," I said. "Want to compare notes?"
"Sure," she said. "What did you get?" I gave her the rundown of what had happened since the last time I'd seen her. She grunted again when I finished. "Isn't that sort of dangerous, involving the vampires?" Yeah, I said. But it's Thomas. I think Lara is probably sincere about getting him back. Besides, why worry about smoking in bed when your building is already on fire?
Point, she said.
I got the photos. They don't tell me anything new. I ran those account numbers you gave me through the system to see if anything came up. Brick wall.
Damn it.
It was a long shot anyway, she said.
Binder give you anything?
Her mouth scrunched up as if she wanted to spit out something that tasted terrible.
No, he's a hard case. Career criminal. He's been grilled before.
Yeah, I said. And he knows you can't do anything but make him sit still for a little while. If he gives us anything on his employer, he'll lose his credibility with clients, assuming that he lives that long.
She leaned her shoulders back against the wall.
You say this Shag Nasty thing has Thomas's cell phone?
Yeah. Think you can track it?
As part of what investigation? She asked.
I don't have the kind of freedom to act that I used to.
If I wanted to get what amounts to a wiretap, I'd have to get approval from a judge.
And I don't know any of them who would take my friend the wizard's vampire brother was kidnapped by a demonic Navajo shapeshifter as a valid justification for such a measure.
I hadn't really thought of it like that, I said.
She shrugged.
Honestly, I suspect Lara's resources and contacts are better than mine, given the time constraints.
I couldn't quite suppress a growl of frustration.
If she learns anything. If she's honest about what she learns.
Murphy frowned, scrunching up her nose.
Where was Thomas taken from?
I'm not certain. But I think he was at the storage park. His rental van was there, and he said something about not being able to handle all of them on his own.
Them? The gray suits?
I nodded.
Most likely. But since Thomas never pitched in during the fight, I figure Shag Nasty probably snuck up on him and grabbed him while he was being distracted by Binder and his pets.
And you can't track him down with magic?
No, I growled through clenched teeth. Shag Nasty is countering it somehow.
How is that possible?
I took a moment to assemble my thoughts.
Tracking spells are like any kind of targeted thaumaturgy. You create a link, a channel to the target, and then pour energy into that channel. In the case of a tracking spell, you're basically just setting up a continuous trickle of energy and then following it to the target. Kind of like pouring water on a surface when you want to see which way is downhill.
Okay, she said. I get that, mostly. The way to stymie a tracking spell is to prevent that channel from ever being formed. If it never gets created, then it doesn't matter when the water gets poured. There's nothing to cause it to start flowing. And the way you prevent the channel from forming is to shield the target away from whatever focus you're using to create the link.
Like what?
Well, for example, if I had one of your hairs and wanted to use it as part of a tracking spell, you might beat it by shaving off your hair. If the hair in my spell doesn't match up to an end somewhere on your head, no link gets created. So unless I had a hair that had been torn out from the roots, and fairly recently, you'd be hidden.
And that's the only way to beat a tracking spell?
Nah, I said. A good circle of power could probably screen you off if you took the time and money to give it serious juice. Theoretically, you could also cross into the never-never. Thaumaturgy originating on the Earth doesn't cross into the spirit world very efficiently. And before you ask, yeah, I tried it from the never-never side, too. It was failed spell number 3.
Murphy frowned.
What about Justine? She asked. Justine was able to find him once before.
I grimaced.
She was able to give us a vague direction a few hours after Thomas had ripped most of the life out of her. It isn't the same this time.
Why not?
Because she wasn't sensing Thomas so much as the missing part of her own life force. They haven't been together like that in years. Thomas digested, I guess you could say, all of that energy a long time ago.
Murphy sighed.
I've seen you do some neat stuff, Harry, but I guess magic doesn't fix everything.
Magic doesn't fix anything, I said.
That's what the person using it is for. I rubbed at my tired eyes.
Speaking of, she said, any thoughts as to why these wizards didn't seem to be using magic?
Not yet, I said. Any thoughts as to the nature of our perpetrator?
A couple, I said.
There are all these disparate elements in play. Shagnasty, Binder, Madeline Wraith. There is serious money moving around. And if we don't find this cockroach and drag him into the light, things are going to be bad for everyone. I don't know what that tells us about him.
That he's really smart, Murphy said. Or really desperate.
I arched an eyebrow. How do you figure?
If he's super brilliant, it's possible that we haven't even seen the shape of his plan yet. All of this could be one big boondoggle to set us up for the real punch.
You don't sound like you think that's the case. She gave a faint smile.
Criminals aren't usually the crispiest crackers in the box. And you have to remember that even though we're flailing around looking for answers, the perp is in the same situation. He can't be sure where we are, what we know, or what we're doing next.
Fog of war, I said thoughtfully. She shrugged.
I think it's a much more likely explanation than that our perp is some kind of James Bond super genius villain slowly unfolding his terrible design. They've shown too much confusion for that.
Like what?
Shagnasty was following you a couple of nights ago, right?
Yeah.
Well, so was this PI you told me about. Why stick you with two tails? Maybe because the right hand didn't know what the left hand was doing.
Huh, I agreed.
From what you say, Shagnasty isn't exactly an errand boy.
No, it isn't.
But it's apparently coordinating with the perp, taking orders. It didn't absolutely need to deliver its demand in person. I think it's pretty obvious that it smashed its way into the chateau to provide a distraction so that Madeline could make her getaway.
I blinked.
Once I'd alerted Lara to the probability of Madeline's treachery, she most certainly would have taken steps to detain her. Madeline must have known that. I tried to remember how long it had been between the time Lucio and I arrived and when the Negloci attacked. Time enough for Madeline to hear about our presence, assume that the worst had happened, and make a call for help?
Maybe.
Murphy peered at me. I mean, it is obvious, right?
I got hit on the head, okay?
She smirked at me.
Hell's bells, I muttered.
Yes, it's obvious, but not necessarily stupid.
Not stupid, but I don't think it would be unfair to call it a desperation move.
I think Shagnasty was the perp's ace in the hole. I think that when Morgan escaped, the perp figured out where he was headed, the pressure got to him, and he played his hole card. Only, when Shagnasty found you, you weren't actually with Morgan. He got spooked when you and the werewolves nearly pinned him down and ran off.
The perp grabs one of his other tools, I said, nodding.
Madeline. Tells her to find me and take me out, make me talk, whatever. Only Thomas beats her senseless instead.
Makes sense, Murphy said.
Doesn't mean that's how it happened.
Had to happen some way, she said.
Say we're in the right ballpark. What does that tell us?
Not much, I said. Some very bad people are in motion. They're tough. The one guy we've managed to grab won't tell us a damn thing. The only thing we're certain we know is that we've got nothing.
I was going to continue, but a thought hit me, and I stopped talking.
I gave it a second to crystallize.
Then I started to smile.
Murphy tilted her head, watching, and prompted,
"We've got nothing?"
I looked from Murphy to the door to the interrogation room.
"Forget it," she said. "He isn't going to put us on to anyone."
"Oh," I drawled. "I'm not so sure about that."
Chapter 31.
Murphy went back into the interrogation room. 20 minutes later, I came in and shut the door behind me. The room was simple and small. A table sat in the middle with two chairs on each side. There was no long two-way mirror on the wall. Instead, a small security camera perched up high in one corner of the ceiling. Binder sat on the far side of the table. His face had a couple of bruises on it, along with an assortment of small cuts with dark scabs. His odd green eyes were narrowed in annoyance. A foot-long hoagie sat on the table in front of him, its paper wrapper partially undone. He'd have been able to reach it easily,
if he could have moved his arms. They were cuffed to the arms of the chair. A handcuff key rested centered on the edge of Murphy's side of the table in front of her chair. I had to suppress a smile. "Bloody priceless," Binder said to Murphy as I entered. "Now you bring this, wanker. It's police torture is what it is. My solicitor will swallow you whole and spit out the bones." Murphy sat down at the table across from Binder, folded her hands, and sat in complete silence, spearing him with an unfriendly stare. Binder sneered at her, and then at me, presumably so I wouldn't feel left out. "Oh, I get this now," he said. "Good cop, bad cop, is it?" He looked at me. "Stone-cold bitch here makes me sit for bloody hours in this chair to soften me up. Then you come in here, polite and sympathetic as you please, and I buckle under the stress, yeah?" He settled more comfortably into the chair, somehow conveying an insult with the motion. "Fine, Dresden," he said. "Knock yourself out. Good cop me." I looked at him for a second. Then I made a fist and slugged his smug face hard enough to knock him over backward in the chair. He just lay there for a minute, on his side, blinking tears out of his eyes. Blood trickled from one nostril. One of his shoes had come off in the fall. I stood over him and glanced at my hand. It hurts to punch people in the face. Not as much as it hurts to get punched in the face, granted, but you know you've done it. My knuckles must have grazed his teeth. They'd lost a little skin. "Don't give me this lawyer crap, Binder," I said. "We both know the cops can't hold you for long, but we also both know that you can't play the system against us, either. You aren't an upstanding member of the community. You're a hired gun, wanted for questioning in a dozen countries." He looked up at me with a snarl. "Think you're a hard man, do you?" I glanced at Murphy. Should I answer that one or just kick him in the balls?
"Seeing is believing," Murphy said.
"True." I turned to Binder and drew back my foot.
"Bloody hell!" Binder barked. "There's a bloody camera watching your every move. You think you won't get dragged off for this?"
An intercom on the wall near the camera clicked and buzzed.
"He's got a point," said Rollins's voice. "I can't see it all from here. Move him a couple of feet to the left and give me about 30 more seconds before he start on his nads. I'm making popcorn."
"Sure," I said, giving the camera a thumbs up. Odds were good that it would fold if I was in the room for any length of time, but we'd made our point. I sat down on the edge of the table, maybe a foot away from Binder, and quite deliberately reached over to pick up the hoagie. I took a bite and chewed thoughtfully.
"Mmm," I said. I glanced at Murphy. "What kind of cheese is that?"
"Gouda."
"Beef tastes great, too."
"Teriyaki," Murph said, still staring at Binder.
"I was really hungry," I told her, my voice brimming with sincerity. "I hadn't eaten since, like, this morning. This is excellent."
Binder muttered darkly under his breath. All I caught was, "Buggering little bastard."
I ate half the hoagie and put it back on the table. I licked a stray bit of sauce off of one finger and looked down at Binder.
"Okay, tough guy," I said. "The cops can't keep you, though that leaves the sergeant here with only a couple of options. Either they let you walk."
Murphy made a quiet growling sound. It was almost as impressive as her grunt.
"She just hates that idea."
I got off the table and hunkered down beside Binder.
"Or," I said, "we do it the other way."
He narrowed his eyes.
"You'll kill me. Is that it?"
"Ain't no one gonna miss you," I said.
"You're bluffing," Binder snapped. "She's a bloody cop."
"Yeah," I said. "Think about that one for a minute. You think a police detective couldn't work out a way to disappear you without anyone being the wiser?" He looked back and forth between us, his cool mask not quite faltering.
"What do you want?"
"Your boss," I said. "Give me that, and you walk." He stared at me for half a minute. Then he said, "Set my chair up." I rolled my eyes and did it. He was heavy.
"Hell's bells, Binder. I get a hernia and the deal's off."
He looked at Murphy and jiggled his wrists. Murphy yawned.
"Bloody hell," he snarled. Just one of them. I haven't eaten since yesterday.
I snorted. Looks to me like you aren't in any immediate danger of starvation.
You want cooperation, he spat. You're gonna have to show me some. Give me the bloody sandwich.
Murphy reached out, picked up the handcuff key, and tossed it to me. I unlocked his left wrist. Binder seized the sandwich and started chomping on it. All right, I said after a moment. Talk.
What? He said through a mouthful of food. No soda.
I swatted the last inch or two of hoagie out of his hand, scowling. Binder watched me, unperturbed. He licked his fingers clean, picked a bit of lettuce out of his teeth, and ate it.
All right, then, he said. You want the truth?
Yeah, I said. He leaned a bit toward me and jabbed a finger at me.
The truth is that you ain't killing no one, Biggin. You ain't, and neither is the blonde bird. And if you try to keep me, I'll bring down all manner of horrible things.
He leaned back in his chair, openly wearing the smug smile again.
So you might as well stop wasting my valuable time and cut me loose. That's the truth.
I turned my head to Murphy, frowning. She got up, walked around the table, and seized Binder by his close-cut hair. It didn't provide much of a grip, but she used it to shove his head roughly down to the top of the table. Then she took the key back from me, undid the other set of cuffs, and released him.
Get out, she said quietly.
Binder stood up slowly, straightening his clothes. He leered at Murphy, winked, and said,
I'm a professional, so there's nothing personal, love. Maybe next time we can skip business and give pleasure a go.
Maybe next time you'll get your neck broken resisting arrest, Murphy said.
Get out.
Binder smirked at Murphy, then at me, and then sauntered out of the room. Well, I asked her. She turned and held out her hand. Several short hairs, some dark and some gray, clung to her fingers.
Got it.
I grinned at her and took the hairs, depositing them in a white envelope I'd taken from Rollins' desk. Give me about a minute and I'll have it up.
Hubba hubba, Rollins said through the intercom speaker. I like this channel.
This is a great way of chasing down the bad guy, Murphy said half an hour later. She gave me a pointed look from her chair at her desk. Sit here and don't do anything. I sat in the chair next to her desk, my hand extended palm down in front of me, holding a bit of leather thong that ended in a simple quartz crystal in a copper wire setting. My arm was getting tired, and I had gripped it under my forearm with the other hand to support it. The crystal didn't hang like a plumb line. It leaned a bit to one side, as if being supported by a steady, silent puff of wind.
Patience, I said. Binder might not be a crispy cracker, but he's been in business for a couple of decades. He knows why you grabbed him by the hair. He's learned to shake off something like this.
Murphy gave me an unamused look. She glanced at Rollins, who sat at his desk. The desks were set up back to back so that they faced each other.
Don't look at me, he said without glancing up from his Sudoku puzzle. I don't run as fast as I used to. I could get used to chasing down bad guys like this.
The crystal abruptly dropped and began swinging back and forth freely.
Ah, I said. There, there, you see?
I let them look for a second and then lowered my arm. I rubbed my sore muscles for a moment.
What did I tell you? He shook it off.
Oh, good, Murphy said. Now we have no clue where he is. I put the crystal into my pocket and grabbed Murphy's desk phone.
Yet, I said.
I punched in a number and found out that you had to dial 9 to get out. I started over, added a 9 to the beginning of the number, and it rang.
Graver, Vince said.
It's Dresden, I said. Tell me what he just did, like 30 seconds ago.
Be patient, Vince said, and hung up on me.
I blinked at the phone. Murphy looked at me for a second and then smiled.
I just love it when I don't know part of the plan and the guy who does is all smug and cryptic, she said. Don't you?
I glowered at her and put the phone down.
He'll call back.
He who? The PI was following Binder, I said. A guy named Vince Graver. Murphy's eyebrows went up.
You're kidding.
Rawlins began to chortle, still working on his puzzle.
What? I said, looking back and forth between them.
He was a vice cop in Joliet a couple of years ago, Murphy said. He found out that someone was beating up some of the call girls down there. He looked into it. Word came down to tell him to back off, but he went and caught a Chicago City councilman who liked to pound on his women for foreplay. What's his name?
Dornan, Rawlins supplied.
Right, Ricardo Dornan, Murphy said.
Huh, I said. Took some guts.
Hell yeah, Rawlins said. And some stupid.
It's a fine line, Murphy said. Anyway, he pissed off some people. Next thing he knows, he finds out he volunteered for a transfer to CPD.
Three guesses where, Rawlins said.
So he resigns, Murphy said.
Yeah, Rawlins said, without even giving us a chance to meet him.
Murphy shook her head. Went into private practice. There's a guy who's a glutton for punishment. Rawlins grinned.
He drives a Mercedes, I said. Has his own house, too.
Rawlins put his pencil down, and they both looked up at me.
I shrugged. I'm just saying. He must be doing all right for himself.
Huh, Rawlins said. Then he picked up his pencil and went back to the puzzle.
Ain't no justice.
Murphy grunted with nigh masculine skill. A couple of minutes later, the phone rang, and Murphy answered it. She passed it to me.
You guy's a nut, Vince said.
I know that, I told him. What's he doing?
Took a cab to a motel on the highway north of town, Vince said. Stopped at a convenience store on the way. Then he goes to his room, shaves himself bald, comes out in his skivvies, and jumps in the damn river. Goes back inside, takes a shower.
How do you know that? I asked.
I broke into his room while he was doing it, Vince said. Maybe you could save your questions until the end of the presentation.
Hard to imagine you not fitting in with the cops, I said.
Vince ignored the comment. He takes a shower and calls another cab.
Tell me you followed the cab, I said.
Tell me your check cleared.
I'm good for it.
Yeah, I'm following the cab right now, Vince said. But I don't need to. He's headed for the Hotel Saks.
Who are you, the amazing Kreskin?
Listened in on the cabbie CB, he said. ETA 18 minutes.
18? I asked.
Usually found between 17 and 19, he said. I can't guarantee I can stay on him at the hotel, especially if he tumbles to the tail. Too many ways out.
I'll take it from there. Do not get too close to him, man. You get an instinct he's looking in your direction, run for the hills. This guy's dangerous.
Yeah, Ben said. Hell, I'm lucky I haven't wet my pants already.
I'm serious.
I know you are. It's cute. 17 minutes.
I'll be there.
With my check. I got a 2-day minimum. You know that, right?
Right, right, I said. I'll be there.
What have we got? Murphy asked as I put the phone down.
Binder thinks he shook me, I said. He's headed for a meeting at Hotel Saks.
She stood up and grabbed her car keys.
How do you know it's a meeting?
Because he's been made.
If he was here alone, he'd be on his way out of town right now, I nodded.
He's running back to whoever hired him.
Who is that? Murphy asked.
Let's find out.
Chapter 32. The Hotel Saks is a pretty good example of its kind in the beating heart of downtown Chicago. It's located on Dearborn, just across the street from the House of Blues. And if you look up while standing outside of the place, it looks like someone slapped one of those fisheye camera lenses on the sky. Buildings stretch up and up and up at angles that seem geometrically impossible. Many similar sections of Chicago have wider streets than you find in other metropolises, and it makes them feel slightly less claustrophobic. But outside of the Saks, the street was barely 3 narrow lanes across, curb to curb. As Murphy and I approached, looking up made me feel like an ant walking along the bottom of a crack in the sidewalk.
It bugs you, doesn't it? Murphy said.
We walked under a streetlight, our shadows briefly equal in length.
What?
Those big things looming over you?
I wouldn't say it bothers me, I said. I'm just aware of them.
She faced serenely ahead as we walked.
Welcome to my life.
I glanced down at her and snorted quietly. We entered the lobby of the hotel, a place with a lot of glass and white paint with rich red accents. Given how late it was no surprise only one member of the staff was visible, a young woman who stood behind one of the glass-fronted check-in counters.